where the water dries up eventually. That's not still water either. What's left is in some places clay, and where there's a bend, it will leave the purest white sand you've ever seen in your life. Now, the Middle Eastern people, Jews and Arabs today, did not live in biblical times, and don't live mostly today on the coast. The sand they used for concrete, for glass, was always sand they mined out of the bottom of a wadi. The rainwater runs through these limestone hills. It melts the limestone. You get all the chemicals that are in limestone, and you get that very fine white silica sand that makes up limestone. Now, listen to a great rabbi. There was a nudnik. I'm sure he said that. I don't think he was speaking Greek. There was a nudnik. We say a foolish man. There was a nudnik who built his house on the sand. Where did the foolish man build his house? In the wadi. It's not the sand that's the problem. Any builder will tell you they'd rather build on sand than clay. Compacts, drains, easy to work with, easy to move. The problem is the guy, it'd be like I said to you, I build a new house. We can look at Lake Michigan out of all four sides. Really, where'd you build it? I build it on the ice of Lake Michigan. And you'd say, well, that's really stupid because the ice is good. That, when Jesus said the stupid man built his house on the sand, they all said, oh, that's, I can't believe he did that. And your little song, actually, very few songs are culturally accurate. They're theologically accurate, but not culturally accurate. And the rains came down and the song has it right. The foolish man built on the wadi, the wise man built on the rock up above, and eventually the house is going to fall. There are a lot of plants in the desert. I like this one. When you're hiking like this and you come across green, you're immediately drawn to it because there's so little green there that when you see it, it's like you know there's got to be fresh water, there's got to be life. And once in a while, there'll be an oasis. This is Elim, where the Israelites stopped, the place of the palm trees, if you read in the book of Exodus, right after crossing the Red Sea. And then, that looks like this. That's Elim. That's all it was, by the way, just those palm trees. And those people were totally pumped about 12 palm trees. But then there's this one. Now, I love this one. I especially like it with people your age because you push them. You start early in the morning and you hike and you hike and it is 120 degrees and you Westerners, unless you come from Arizona, aren't used to this. I'm certainly not in the Middle East. In the Midwest, you get to the Middle East and it's like oppressive and the sun beats down on you and you just don't know after a while how you can go any farther. And then in the distance, you'll see this tree. Just one. Now, it doesn't grow by water. Well, it does grow by water, but it doesn't have to be by water. They say the roots go down 150, 180 feet. I don't know this. I'm not a botanist. But that's what I've been told by people who I think know. But for whatever reason, it can grow in the middle of the desert where there's nothing else alive besides scorpions and hyenas within miles. And so you see it. And students will run to it. And when you get up close, you can see that the fruit is huge. I mean, grapefruit size. It stays green, but grapefruit size, and they feel like they're absolutely full of juice. And of course, students, can we have one? Is it okay to eat? You know, it's like, whoa, this would be so cool. So the first student takes one off the tree, and you break it open, and it's empty. There's nothing inside but air and pollen. And when you break it open, it goes puck. And you get a little puff of dust and a little white juice that comes out of the skin that's highly poisonous. Better when you use it on their arrows to shoot hyenas, because if it gets in the bloodstream, it will kill the hyena if you get enough in the bloodstream. Now that tree is called an arara. Say arara.
Arara.
Arara. Say it again. Arara.
Arara.
Thank you. We run into a problem. As Westerners, when your wonderful Bible translators translated the Hebrew into English, they came across the word arara. But what's an arara? Nobody knows what an arara is. So they picked a translation of arara, bush. Now that's not false. It is a bush. The problem is you can't ever understand. Listen to Jeremiah. Cursed is the one who depends on his own strength. Who trusts on her arm of flesh. This one will be like an arara in the desert, living in a wasteland, in a salt land where no one else lives. An arara is something that looks great on the outside. It's wonderful. It's unbelievable. And when you break it open, there's nothing inside but death. If you are studying building your career and your life and your relationships in your own strength, then you are an arara in the desert. You look awesome. Look at you. I can't imagine how many awards and degrees and good grades and compliments and stuff that hangs on your refrigerators and walls and stuff at home. If you did it in your own strength and someone were to crack you open, there would be nothing inside but death. Now, if you don't know the arara tree, cursed is the one who depends on his own strength, on her arm of flesh. He or she will be like a bush in the wasteland.
What verse is that?
Jeremiah 17. I don't know the exact verse. He follows that up in Jeremiah 17 by saying, blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, for he, she will be like a tree planted by streams of water. Now, anyway, I could sit all day by an arara tree. It just moves my soul, because I tell you the truth, I was 25 years old with 3 degrees after high school. I know rectal thermometers, but 3 degrees after high school, and I had done it all myself. And if you had looked into my soul, there was only death. I didn't like me. I didn't like my life. And then, on a day in Israel, I blew away, ask me later, I'll do it during question, I blew away a Jewish rabbi. It's the only Jewish rabbi in history who ever was teaching Jews about synagogue and converted somebody to Christianity. At that instant, I became a believer in Jesus. And my whole world changed. The gospel moved from here to here. And I went from being an arara tree to an acacia tree. If you got questions, you got to ask. This is a smorgasbord, so I don't mind. I'll show you as many as I'm watching the time. Here's another one. This one also grows in the desert. It often gets ripped to shreds, but because the roots are in the rock, it survives. It's called hyssop. Hyssop is a tree that grows in the most rugged conditions. It produces a fruit that looks like a cattail. You know cattails? We call them cattails in the Midwest. I don't know what you call them. They're reeds with this like brown corn dog thing on the end of a... Sorry to say that here, but this brown corn dog thing on the end of a stick. Cattails. They take those cattails and they boil them. And the water is, after they've boiled them for a long time, the water turns into a substance very close to lye. L-Y-E. You know lye? They used it to tan leather. It separates the flesh from the skin of the animal. They used it to clean the bones of the animal to get all the flesh off so they could use the bones for needles and things like that. That's hyssop. So when David says in Psalm 51, after sinning with Bathsheba, God, wash me with hyssop that is stronger than you know. It's like, put me in acid and burn this thing out of me. It's a very strong image if you understand hyssop. Also in Jesus' death, where the hyssop was on the cross, there's something about that as well. That's what hyssop looks like. This is the shade tree of the desert. It's called rotem in Hebrew, broom tree. That is the only shade tree that exists with any regularity. I've seen on many occasions, you'll be hiking and there'll be a shepherd. The sheep will be laying up against a cliff somewhere, and the shepherd will be laying with her body out in the sun and her head stuck in the shade. And then when it gets cooler in the afternoon, then she'll get up and bring the sheep back out. Now, in that desert, particularly for a Westerner, but even for those people, in the heat of the day, you will not survive in the sun. And every Middle Easterner knows the most dangerous part of your body to be exposed to the sun is your head. I have the toughest time bringing people like you to hike in the desert and convincing you to wear a hat. You don't want to wear a hat. What you don't realize is the head is the part of the body that absorbs the most heat, just like it's the part of the body that releases the most heat. It's where the blood is the closest to the surface. And when you get your head in the sun, your body reacts by lowering the blood supply to the brain. And when you lower the blood supply to the brain, you slow the thinking process and you do stupid things. And it's the uncovered head, in Hebrew you say, it's the uncovered head that kills you in the desert. Because you'll die. People do unbelievable things when they have been overcome with the heat and they make decisions that are terrible. The Middle Easterner, when you hike, they'll always see the Americans and they'll go, tell them to put a hat on. She's got to have a hat on. Tell her to get her hat on. If you're thirsty, you've waited way too long. Now, let's talk about the picture. The desert, in the biblical metaphor, in the biblical world, the desert is the place where you live when life is tough. It's so hot, you don't know if you're going to take another step. Now, I don't know you, unfortunately, but I don't know you. There's got to be somebody here today that's in the desert. There's somebody in your family that doesn't love Jesus. A relationship has just broken up that is devastating you. A friend has just died. A family member has a terrible disease. I don't know what. There's something that's absolutely, and you're thinking to yourself, I don't know if I can take another step. That's what it's like to be in the desert. The sun will not strike you by day or the moon by night. The moon is about cold in the Middle East. Now, the Bedouin know, when the desert gets unbearable, what you look for is enough shade to cover your head. It just breaks me. I wish I could tell you that when you are in the desert of life, and maybe you're there today, maybe you're not. If you're not, remember when you were. And if you've never been, you will. I wish I could tell you that what God promises you is when your desert gets really hot, He is going to lower the temperature to about 68 and the humidity to about 1%. And He's going to bring a cool breeze and a big oak tree with shade. Now, praise the Lord, He does that. You know what happens more often than not? All you get is enough shade to survive. And part of the dilemma that the Western approach to the Bible has created is we have a Christian world that thinks that if you're a believer, life is going to be roses. And when the desert comes, we can't handle it. Where are you, God? How could you? Now, those are good questions to ask. Let me tell you something. God, the Bible never promises you anything more than enough shade to take one more step. That's all. Or another, you'll see how the desert metaphors all point in the same direction. Oh, that's an awesome one too. I'll skip that one. That's a good friend of mine. They live in the desert too. As do they. I mentioned those guys, I think I showed you before. Let me pick one that I don't have up here, just to pick a place here once. Okay. One more, yep. Why don't I just go back to the beginning here? Okay. In the biblical world, there are a whole lot of metaphors. Two I'd like to have you think about. Honey in the Bible is always a metaphor for the sweetness of God. Dvash, you say in Hebrew. Dvash. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Taste. The words had the taste to me of the sweetness of honey. Honey always to a Middle Easterner is about God. I remember the first time I was in Israel, first week of class, friend said, why don't you come home with me for the week? He felt bad for me because I was such a total Western nudnik. He knew I could never survive by myself in Jerusalem. So he took me home. And I think classes started again on Tuesday, so we were there on a Monday, Sunday or Monday, I don't remember. And his sister was the kindergarten teacher at the school in their town. So he said, let's come with my sister. You can see a school. You can see my sister teaching. So I went. It was the first day of class. And she sat with about 35 kindergartners in this room. Now, you got to picture these kindergartners. You probably have seen it. You probably don't remember it yourself. Maybe you do. Some of them are scared to death. Some of them are crying. Some of them are acting, you know, like they're okay. Some are just sitting there frozen. There they all sit. So the teacher gets up and says some nice things, and then the door opens. It's an Orthodox school. In comes the rabbi. Very pleasant looking, big bearded man. Look at the rabbi. And the rabbi looked around the room, and he walked over to his box on his desk, took out of his box a whole bunch of new, brand new Torahs. Torah. One for you, one for you, one for your little kids, you know, big eyes. Then he went back over to his box and he came out with a handful of little squares of wax paper. And he laid one on the cover of each of those Torahs. And then he walked back and he came out with a good old-fashioned honey bear. And he squeezed a drop of honey on each wax paper. And then he said, "Now I want you to take your little finger and I want you to dip it in the honey and I want you to lick it off." All these little kids. "And don't ever forget, that's what God tastes like." Come with me. 8 years later, I'm in a doctoral class with a gentleman named Chaim Potok. First day of class, he walks in, goes to his box, takes out a Torah. And each of those 30, 28, 25, 35-year-old get a brand new Torah. And then a wax paper square. And then a honey bear. "Take your little finger and dip the honey and lick it off. That is what God tastes like." That moved me. That's honey. The other metaphor is rock. And you don't have to see very many of these slides to realize how common or why that's such a common metaphor. It's everywhere. It means a lot of things. Stability, unbreakability, has all kinds of meanings. Typical Hebrew fashion. Images have, yeast can be good, yeast can be bad. It's whatever you need at the moment. But one of the metaphors in the Bible is that life is a pathway. And when you walk on life's pathway, excuse me, there are rocks. Sometimes they're the foot of, no, there are rocks. And they're all different sizes. So you're walking right now on life's pathway. What are the rocks in your path? Okay, so you got a few issues back home that you wish you were there, you could solve, but you can't. But they're like small stones. They're annoying, they're frustrating, but you keep going. And then you've got a couple of bigger ones. Concern for a friend, concern for a disease, I don't know, same things I mentioned before. And then you've got some great big ones. Somebody's really sick. Then you've got one you walked up against 6 months ago where somebody died, and you're saying to yourself, "I can't go by this." Now listen to Psalm 81. "If my people would listen to me, if they would only obey me, I would satisfy them with honey from the rock." Where is God on life's pathway? In the tough times. There is enough of God in every rock you hit. Not to make the rock feel good. They hurt. He knows that. His son had the same thing. There is enough of God in every rock on every path of life to take one more step. And I'm not promising you roses. All I'm saying to you is if you follow Jesus and you're on a God path, there is no rock without enough honey to take another step. Have you been there? Think back in your life. When was God the most intense? Isn't it often in the toughest times? But what if I'm on the wrong path? What's in the rocks then? Clue. Nothing. The desert is about hearing. Who asked me the question? Did you? Were you that one that asked me the question to repeat that? Who asked me to repeat that about the desert and God speak? Thank you. The desert is where you hear God because there's nowhere else to turn. You need to live in the desert. You can take the believer out of the desert. You better not take the desert out of the believer. If you and I don't live every single minute, totally, do something for me. Take out your Bibles. Matthew 5. Please stand up. In Jewish world, you always stand when God speaks. Okay? I need a volunteer, or several. Just do this by volunteer. I don't need to point you out. Somebody, I want to read the Beatitudes. Somebody read verse 1 and verse 2 and so on. Somebody start. Stop. Read that once more. Okay. Someone else.
Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted.
Read that again, please.
Blessed are those who mourn, for they.
Now that's Jewish. You read it louder the second time. Make the impact. Okay. Somebody else.
Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the
earth. Once more.
Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth.
Good. Again. Next.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied.
Once more.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness.
Next.
Blessed are the
merciful, for they
shall receive mercy.
Next.
Next.
Next. Again. Next. What? Read that again.
Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of.
Okay, please sit down. Listen to me. Are you telling me that it's good to be poor and hungry and mourn and persecuted? And you're telling me it's good when everybody says slanderous, rotten, lousy things about you? Why is that good? What is that? It's the desert. And what happens when you're in the desert? You find God. You know why you're blessed when you mourn? Not because God is going to come along and say, it's okay, the person died and went to heaven, don't worry, you'll see him again someday, feel better. It hurts when somebody dies. Jesus himself cried at his friend's funeral. You know why you're blessed when you mourn? Because when you mourn, there's nowhere else to turn but God. And you're going to come face to face with God in a way you haven't before. In all your pain, you'll look God right in the eye. And that is a blessing. I don't care what your circumstances are. You know why it's good to be hungry? Because in your hunger, you turn and you see God and you say, God, I can't make it anymore. And you know God in a way you didn't when your refrigerator was full of stuff. And Jesus walked out into the desert because he wanted to see God face to face. And the devil said, you don't have to depend on God in the desert. You have power. Make stones into bread. And Jesus said, no. Why? Because he wanted to depend on God. And he wanted to be hungry enough for the tears to run down his face because he wanted to see God face to face. And so when you stand in the desert of your life or you stand with somebody in the desert of your life, don't try and turn it into Hawaii. When you stand in the desert of your life, help that person who you stand with or you yourself say, now where in this desert am I going to stand face to face with God? I love the desert. It hurts. It's my favorite place in Israel. It hurts. We die out there, and then we get bitten by scorpions and who knows what. Because when you're there, God is very real. And part of Western Christianity's problem is that by taking the biblical message out of its context, we've made the Christian life sound like it ought to be Hawaii. And sometimes it is. But we're scared to death of pain. And we're scared to death to take up our cross. And we're scared to death to suffer. Because we haven't understood that it's in those circumstances that you really know God. No, I went way too far. Okay. Let's go back a little bit. There are people who live there. Is there a question? This just moves my soul to be there. I want to know God so real. I want God to, even if I've got to hurt to get there, I want to see God right in His eyes. Listen. Speaking to Israel, your mother was a vine in your vineyard, planted by the water. She was very fruitful and covered with branches because of the abundant water. But because she did not keep her commands, she is now planted in the desert where there is no water. And I will lead you into that desert, and there, face to face, I will speak to you. I love this. Anyway, question. Say it. If some, maybe you don't have one.
That is
Ezekiel 19 and Ezekiel 30. Put a question mark by 30. I put two verses together because they share the same word. There are people who live here, and of course, they have nothing. That's what it's like living in the desert as well. You know that basically, I don't care what you have under the roof at home, you basically have nothing besides God. And I'm going to skip over this. Oh, that, by the way, is a manger. Next to the water supply, this happens to be a wadi cistern. Next to the water supply are little depressions in the rock, and that's a manger. Now, put that in your Christmas creche. I have a hard time going to church on Christmas. I honestly do. As much as I bless God and bless God for my congregation, Christmas is so culturally inaccurate. People, there hasn't been a cow in Bethlehem in 1,000 years. There aren't any cows there. And mangers are not little cross-legged wooden boxes with golden straw in them. Mangers are water troughs. They probably had to drain the water and put an old sheepskin and laid the Son of God on an old sheepskin. The prettier you make Christmas, the more you miss the point. God left heaven to be born in 6 feet of sheep manure because He wanted to say, I love you. And with our pine scent and our golden straw, we almost make it seem kind of possible. I missed the point. Anyway, that's a manger. And you find them often. That's Abraham. Ibrahim, good friend of mine. Remember him? Ireland. Hospitality. I maintain God chose Middle Eastern people because their whole world is hospitality. They give you the last ounce of flour they had and serve you bread while they sat and had nothing.
What were they making back then?
Here?
Yeah.
That's pita. It pita. Arabic for bread. It's pita bread. You mix flour and water and salt, roll it out flat, and honestly, we'll show up with 55 students like you. They don't know we're coming. You show up in the middle of the desert, and they will give you the last ounce of flour they own. They will die of starvation rather than let you die. Listen, that's the whole thing of, you prepare a table before me. It is, anyway, it's pita bread. And you sit, and they pull it off, and they hand it to the guest of honor. It's so hot you can hardly hold it. And you rip off a piece and hand it to the next one. Rip off a piece, hand it to the next one. And they'll sit around that fire for 3 hours. And that's called breaking bread together. And the process of making the bread is as much a part of hospitality as the process of eating the bread. We miss that in the West. For us, hospitality is the meal's already, you come in and sit down. And Well, anyway, I'm way off the subject here, but good question. Other questions? The shepherds in the Middle East, I've got to move on or I won't have time to finish this, are almost always little girls under menstruation, age of menstruation, and older women. I have never seen in my life, in this desert culture, an adult male shepherd. Now put that into your Christmas. Those shepherds that Christmas were little girls. Or maybe pre-adolescent boys. And if there was a man among them, it would have been at least unusual. I don't know why we miss the point that God so often chooses the weak and the young. Imagine a 12-year-old girl showing up at the manger. I went to church 2 years ago, and we were having our Christmas program. I had to go because I have a grandson, and he was in it. Christmas programs drive me crazy, not because they're bad. I bless God for the, but it's so culturally inaccurate. I just like, oh, Jesus wasn't born in Germany. He was born in Israel. And he didn't look like a member of the Swedish ski team. He was African, for Pete's sake. Dark skin, curly. Why do we turn him into this Dutch or Swedish European? Anyway, so I'm in the back. And here are all the shepherds, and they're all the little girls. About third graders got to be the shepherds in the Christmas program. It's like, yes! So we sat down, Christmas program began. Here came all the shepherds down the aisle, and they'd given them all beards. It's like, oy, Gaval. So the shepherds live in the desert. Again, here's the shepherds. Yes, sir?
Where are the men in this community?
To be honest, men do very little of anything. And you could argue whether that's changed at all or is the same in the West, but you could argue, I said. I didn't say I'd believe that. Honestly, the men will get involved in shearing the sheep, and when the lambs are being born, the men will do some of that. But water, cooking, caring for the sheep, making the tents, that's all women's work. Listen, there's something in that. When the Bible makes God a shepherd, that's a multifaceted image. Because we assume the Lord is my shepherd. It's this big, strong guy with a stick. The Lord is my shepherd not only stresses the sufficiency of the shepherd who knows living water from killing water, who knows green pastures, who understands sheep and knows the difference between sheep and goats. The Bible also assumes that the shepherd is somebody who is gentle like a 12-year-old girl. And if there is a shepherd, he's sitting under the shade of a rock watching his daughters do the work. I spent 6 weeks living with this family, not this family, the family before. And for five and a half days, they let me go out into the desert, which is very unusual because I was a Western man, spoke no Arabic, with the daughter. The daughter was 13, something, I couldn't get the age because they don't have birth certificates, but something like 13 years old. She had not menstruated yet, so she was not marrying age. And she went with a little sister, I would guess was 6, and a little brother who was maybe 7 or 8. They were at least 20 miles from home. She had 150 sheep, and we were gone 5.5-6 days. Sheep have to drink twice a day. If that girl had not known where the water was, every one of those sheep would have died. And they trusted that girl with the whole family's wealth. I couldn't believe it. I learned more about God in 5.5-6 days than I had learned in my whole seminary career, watching that little girl. A Jew will tell you when David killed Goliath, he's got to be somewhere between 7 and maybe 11. Doesn't say. Was there another one?
You think David was a shepherd just because he was weaker and smaller?
Why was David the shepherd? He's the youngest. Now, there's power in that story too. David comes because he's caring for the sheep. This is a kid. He's probably, figure he's 10. And Goliath comes up and starts insulting Israel and God. Your mother wears combat sandals. I don't know what they said to insult people in those days. Something. And this little kid says to these soldiers, "What's this? How can he insult God?" Shut up. Who are you? You're with the sheep. David said he shouldn't do that. Somebody should do something. So they bring him to Saul. And David does a very Jewish thing that the Westerners totally miss. David insults Saul in one of the most sarcastic exchanges you've ever heard in your life. Help me. Who is Saul? King. What is the king of Israel? What is the metaphor in the Bible for the king of Israel? The shepherd, the carer of God's flock. What has Saul done when the flock was threatened? Nothing. He's up in the hills. He won't even go down there. And how is Saul different from the other Israelites? He's bigger, just like... So David comes up to him, and Saul says, I'll paraphrase, what makes you equipped to do something here? And David said, I was a shepherd. Like you're a shepherd, Saul, is implied. And when a lion came and took a sheep, and a bear came and killed a sheep, it doesn't say, David said, and I went out and fought with the lion. It says, I followed him and tracked him down and killed him. David didn't have to fight the lion. He didn't have to fight the bear. But dadgummit, if he was responsible before God for those sheep and some lion had the guts to come and attack him, he'd go track him out into the desert and find him and kill him if he had to. Saul, what you been doing lately? I was sitting here on the hill under this tree. And David says, then let me fight him. He's just a kid. Again, Saul's age is not given. What the estimate is that he must have been in his 40s or 50s based on Jewish tradition in part, and given the sequence, the problem is the Bible is not always sequential, but given the sequence of events that have led from Saul's becoming king to David's fighting Goliath. It's out of order in the Bible anyway, because David has already been Saul's armor bearer. So that story... The writer is putting the stories, which bothers Westerners to no end, but in the East, chronology doesn't matter to the story, it's theology. Second question.
Why, I've heard that like, they were all the way to
There's two reasons that the women wear clothing, like that. This girl I showed you is a little more traditional. She's been to a mission somewhere, honestly. That's why she's wearing your sweaters. This is much more typical. A woman covers herself like a man covers himself because even though that holds the heat of the body in, it means you absorb less of that 120 degree heat from the sun. And in the long run, believe it or not, we take students hiking. They start out, everybody wants, you know, tank top type things and shorts, and the guys have their t-shirts off, and that lasts a couple of hours. Then the sun gets up about, and there the clothes start to come back on. And it isn't at all unusual for people then to start with long sleeves, because you absorb so much heat when you're in that direct sun. You can't leave your body uncovered, especially if you're white. If you're darker, at least you have that advantage. But there's a second reason why a woman always wears dark. You are not allowed, as a woman, in the Middle Eastern culture, ever to be in a position where your body shape can be seen. And if you wore white clothing and you stood against the sun, you could see the outline of your legs and your body as the sun shone behind the white clothing. So women always wear dark. And that's just one of the sufferings. The suffering of a woman begins on the day of her birth, wrote an ancient rabbi. The suffering of man begins on the eighth day after birth, circumcision. So that's a woman. You know, there's another thing here. And again, I beg your pardon that you feel like I'm wandering, but this is the Jewish way to do it, believe it or not. There's a Jewish prayer in the morning. You say 18 benedictions. Avinu Shabbat Shemaim, Yitchadesh Shimcha, Tamlich Malchu, Ye'aseh Ritzanka Bashemaim Uva'aretz, Et Lechem Ukeinu Ten Lanu Hayom. Of the 18 blessings in the morning, six of them ended up in the Lord's Prayer. All Jesus did was pull phrases out of the typical Jewish prayer in the morning and made those six of the eight phrases in the Lord's Prayer. But the 13th of the 18th is, I bless you, God, that you did not make me a woman. if you're a man, you say that particular prayer. Now, that I've heard so many Christian thinkers say, what an incredible anti-feminine. But it's exactly the opposite if you understand the Jewish thinking. The Jewish person is thinking, a woman has to wear black in the hot sun. She has a monthly menstrual cycle. She's got to go through labor pain. She has all the issues involved in child care, nursing, and all of the things that a man can't even participate in. I couldn't handle that. I bless you, God, that you gave women the task you gave them, because I, as a man, couldn't handle what they have to handle. And actually, that prayer is a real affirmation of femininity, because it's saying God gave womanness to the sex that was strong enough to handle it. Because men, there would nobody ever have more than one child if men had to give birth. I've been there and watched it, I can promise you. Everybody would have one child if men had to do that part of it. Anyway, this is the woman I spent time with, the girl that I spent time with. Let me show you something here out of the desert. Oh, this is another one. It reminds me of this class a little bit. We need to take a break too. This reminds me of this class a little bit. Notice that in the Middle East, sheep always follow the shepherd. I have never seen a shepherd chase sheep, ever. Never. Not unless somebody gets in the flock like a bunch of Westerners and scatters them. Sometimes they end up. But the shepherd is probably 100 meters ahead, and she's calling in Arabic. And the sheep, I remember one night sleeping. We were hiking in the desert, and we found a little Roman fort. And so we thought, good place. It was ruined, of course. Good place to some shade from the sun right now and some break from that hot, hot wind or that cold, cold wind at night. So we laid our stuff there inside and went out for a walk. We came back, and several shepherds had come out of the desert with their flocks of sheep and goats. And they all put them in that fort as a sheepfold for the night. Well, they walked all over our stuff, and they all thought it was a bank and left deposits. It was a mess. So we picked up all our stuff and found another place. And then I remember we were talking, saying, how are they going to sort? There must have been 500 sheep in there belonging to at least four different flocks. In the morning, each shepherd walked some distance away from the opening, maybe 200 meters, turned around and called in Arabic. And out of that 500 would come only the sheep that belonged to that shepherd. In a straight line, behind her. And for the first time in my life, I understood Jesus' words. I am the good shepherd. Whoever hears my voice will follow me. Jesus is not running around behind you on weekends or any other time, beating you, saying, hey, get in, not there. Jesus says, hey guys, the pasture and the water is here. Come on. What are you going to do? Now I'll show you what the sheep do. See them? Now check out the goats. Goats are always, a goat always knows a better way. I understand why in the Bible, at the last judgment, the sheep go to heaven and the goats all go to hell. Any shepherd will tell you why. Because a goat always knows it better. So when Jesus says, hey folks, it's like this, and you say, well, maybe when I'm 26. Hi, goat. Honestly. The most amazing thing, by the way, about those sheep that morning in that Roman fort is that whole flock of sheep knew Arabic. And that is a hard language. It's incredible. I couldn't get over that. How in the world did all those sheep know Arabic? Anyway, anything come to mind? Look here. Thank you. And you know what? I got the wrong program up here, but I'll tell you anyway, and I'll pull the pictures up and show you later, because I don't want to waste your precious time. There should have been two more slides in here. I remember the first time I learned about this was in a place something like this, and I was laying here early in the morning as the sun came up with several other Israeli students, and several shepherds came with their goats and sheep wandering down the wadi, and I could see the sheep were grazing, and I could see the paths on the hillside where they had grazed. And I'm looking at this thinking, what on earth do those sheep eat? Are those rock-eating sheep? I mean, it is absolutely incredible. I grew up on a farm. We didn't have any sheep, but I know farming. I'm gonna find the slides. Just pardon me just a second. Because I think it's worth your seeing the green pastures. So I'm on my elbow taking notes. I'm a Westerner, and thinking, okay. I look over and there's an Israeli waking up, and he's stretching. University student. He's stretching and looking. And so I said to him, "What do those sheep eat?" And of course he laughed. They thought I was such an idiot. Here's a guy with a master's degree, and he doesn't know what sheep eat. It's like, so he said, "Well, let me show you something." He said, "If you look at these hillsides carefully, you'll notice." Give me just a second here. It'll come. Okay, here we go. This will get you the actual slide of that morning. It's pretty faded because it's like 30, 25 years ago. Okay. It's this one. That was the flock. Yeah, you can hardly see it. It's so. Let me go to a better one than that. So I said to him, "What do those sheep eat?" And he said, "Well, look once. Notice the hills are all random, but they graze certain hills and not others." Now, he said, "If you'll just pay attention, you'll notice that every evening about sunset, you get a strong breeze from the west." Now, what's west of the desert? Mediterranean Sea. And the breeze is humid, and I had not noticed that, but it is. Now, when that breeze hits the stones, moisture accumulates. Not like you can squeeze it, but little drips of water. And overnight, little tufts of grass grow from behind or next to where those stones are. And the sheep move across. The shepherd has to find the hillsides that are exposed. And they simply move from rock to rock to rock and get a mouthful here, a mouthful here, and a mouthful here. Well, I'd never heard, I'm writing furiously. I'd never heard anything like that in my whole life. That's crazy. I mean, so I said to him, "Well, what do you call this?" And he did the Jewish thing, which is to recite scripture. "The Lord leads me into..." People, this is the green pastures of Psalm 23. I'm not kidding. You can keep your old picture on the wall if you want. You can keep the picture in your head if you want. Now listen, he then became animated. I would even say angry. He said, "You Westerners all turn Psalm 23 into belly deep alfalfa. The Lord leads me into green pastures," which means he's going to plunk you down where you have everything you need for the rest of your life. He said to me, "Do you have what it takes to handle what's going to happen to you in 10 minutes?